Welcome to The Victory Kitchen, the podcast all about American food rationing during World War II. I'm your host, Sarah Creviston Lee, author, historian, and vintage foodie. I'll be exploring the logistics of food rationing, featuring wartime cookbooks and recipes, and highlighting real homefront experiences. We're going to be learning exactly what our grandmothers had to do to get their food to fight for victory. Hello! Welcome to The Victory Kitchen. This is episode 28, and we are going to start this episode off with a little story. This is from the Grand Island Daily Independent from the 23rd of January, 1943. It starts off, "It happened at the Hollywood canteen. A soldier jostled through to the snack bar. A movie star behind the counter smiled at him. Coffee? Yes, ma'am," said the soldier, his eyes following her expectantly. "Your face is familiar." The actress grinned. "Are you kidding? Now don't tell me we've met." "As a matter of fact," said the soldier, "we have." He tossed a dull ringing coin on the counter. "Hey, Rube," he yelled. The actress looked at him, startled. She picked up the coin, then stared at him. "Malty," she shouted. "And how did you expect me to recognize you with that funny haircut?" The soldier and the movie star talked of Brooklyn and a girl named Ruby Stevens, who wrapped bundles in a big department store, who spent her nickels with the soda jerk who always sold her a malt for 5 cents. The soldier, Harry Ryder, former soda jerk, Brooklyn. The girl, the former Brooklyn bundle wrapper, Barbara Stanwyck. So that is a fun little anecdotal story that I came across. And yes, this episode, we are going to be talking about soda fountains. Now, what is it about soda fountains that is so nostalgic for Americans? There's just something about it that the idea of soda fountains that is at the core of the identity of American culture. It's more than just the ice cream and the ice cream sodas. And it was something in wartime that we felt needed to be protected as sacred and vital for morale. And that's something we're going to dig into in this episode. And, you know, there are quite a few films that feature soda fountains. Maybe there's some you're thinking of right now. Recently, I saw The Best Years of Our Lives for the first time. It was filmed in 1946, or at least it came out in 1946, starring Dana Andrews and Myrna Loy. And I really enjoyed that. There's a really great soda fountain scene in that film. So just keep these soda fountains in mind when we're talking about soda fountains and the pulls of those nostalgic heartstrings when we're talking about. Now, to understand ice cream's place in America during wartime, I thought it was important to understand America's relationship with ice cream and the iconic soda fountain in relation to our identity and larger culture. Now, think about the, you know, iconic vintage soda fountain you may have seen, you know, depicted in these films or Coca-Cola ads or captured in photographs. This was a place for teens to hang out. It was a place for busy workers to grab a quick lunch, a place to socialize and relax. Soda fountains, and most especially ice cream, held a significant symbolism in the American psyche. I found this to be quite true in references to ice cream. In the magazine Counter Freezer News from October 1944, it says, "Ice cream. To the overseas soldier, those words really mean something. The most common wish over a mess gear is to have the darned thing piled high with good ice cream and the mess cup brimming full with a malted milk for a kicker. Practically every American who stands on foreign battlegrounds has one aim, to return home. Ice cream has become a symbolic promise of what home can mean to the American soldier." So there's one example. Ice cream equals home. And then in the book A Square Meal by Jane Ziegelman and Andrew Coe, I found some interesting references to soda fountains as well. They say soda fountains becoming entrenched in American culture goes back earlier to the 1920s, where their popularity and the consumption of sugar soared thanks partially to Prohibition. Like Matt Siegel says in his book, The Secret History of Food, ice cream stood in for alcohol as of national comfort and diversion. And even at that early time, they held the belief that sugar was a relatively healthy energy food. So, you know, by the 1940s, that tradition of getting a sundae or an ice cream soda or even a quick bite to eat at the soda fountain was a firm and unique part of the American culture. Now we're going to turn to the American idea of this versus the world viewpoint. So this viewpoint of the world versus America's obsession with ice cream clashing with wartime is a very interesting perspective. In the book Of Sugar and Snow, A History of Ice Cream Making by Jerry Quinzio, they say Britain had strict rationing and ice cream was prohibited from being made, although they allowed some ersatz products. Mussolini outlawed ice cream in Italy. In Japan, the emperor ordered ice cream to be priced so low that it was impossible for manufacturers to make it. And then going back to the counter freezer news, they talk about when the Nazis caught wind that the U.S. Army hospital had installed a couple ice cream machines for the benefit of the patients, they couldn't help but take a stab at us. It says, Nazi Sally, propagandizing our troops, termed us the ice cream front and boasted of the near future when they would blast every freezer out from under you. This is a good reflection of how the world saw ice cream and maybe how they saw us. America's viewpoint on ice cream, on the other hand, was different. So, you know, around the world, we've definitely got a different viewpoint on ice cream. Austerity, you know, ice cream is not a necessity. And seeing Americans' viewpoint on ice cream is like, what is wrong with you people? But on America's side, we've got a completely different point of view. In the book Sunday Best, A History of Soda Fountains by Ann Cooper Funderburg, she talks about this viewpoint. She says, in the midst of World War II and Circular Number 153, the United States War Department recognized the importance of soda fountain treats to American GIs. This circular listed six items essential to soldier morale: confections, soft drinks, ice cream, tobacco products, basic toiletries, and cleaning kits. So just think about that. Like, those things all lumped together, ice cream and soft drinks right in there. So, to assure an adequate supply of these items at all stateside military bases, the Office of the Quartermaster General arranged priority allotment certificates. Thousands of new soda fountains were opened at Army post exchanges, service clubs, USO clubs, naval training stations, and aboard ships. In leave clubs throughout Europe and the South Pacific, the Red Cross operated soda fountains and snack bars. They also served ice cream and soft drinks at evacuation stations, airports, and bivouac areas whenever possible. And since the troops wanted real American ice cream, the Red Cross worked hard to get the real ingredients, working with antiquated ice cream making equipment. In Italy, for example, the Red Cross operated seven small ice cream plants despite frequent interruptions of electricity. When all these plants were operating at full capacity, they produced 1,000 gallons per day. That is incredible. I say kudos to the Red Cross. They really went above and beyond to make this ice cream happen for our troops. There were also reports of an industrious mess sergeant and his crew giving foxhole ice cream service. They had rigged up a freezer and, using the ice provided them, were delivering ice cream along with chow to the boys in their gun nests. So what a surprise that must have been, and an effective morale stimulant too. And one of my favorite stories, I had to hunt this story down. There's references to it in other places, like in ads, and there's some fantastic, I found a fantastic picture in a Life magazine. The issue is in the mail, so I will hopefully have that on my blog so you can see it. It's It's fantastic. So the original article was reported in the New York Times, the 13th of March, 1943. The headline is Flying Fortress Doubles as Ice Cream Freezers. So these enterprising pilots made ice cream in their bomber planes while flying over Germany. And the article says, United States airmen based on British stations have discovered a handy way of making ice cream. They place prepared ice cream mixture in a large can and anchor it to the rear gunner's compartment of a flying fortress. It is well shaken up and nicely frozen by flying over enemy territory at high altitudes. Care must be taken to drop bombs and not ice cream on enemy targets and to avoid Nazi fighters and anti-aircraft fire. So that's it for that article, but subsequent takes on the event, you know, they took this article and embellished it way more. So, like, there was this ad in the Marion Star of Ohio with the headline, Three direct hits, sir, and 10 quarts of vanilla. Thus replies a tail gunner to the pilot of a Boeing Fortress while flying over Germany in response to the query, how are we doing? Nazi factory right on the nose, added the gunner, and the ice cream's ready to eat. They had anchored a can of ice cream mix in the gunner's compartment. Now, after dodging flak and fighters 6 miles up at 60 degrees below, it was well shaken and well frozen. Safe back at base, they celebrated the raid with their favorite food treat. That's an American way of celebrating ice cream. As American as baseball or the 4th of July. Oh my gosh. This is the extent our flyers and others in the armed forces will go to have ice cream. The people on the home front, however, don't have to resort to freezing the mix in the stratosphere. They can always enjoy good ice cream so long as they insist on quality. Italy's. Oh my gosh. It almost makes you want to gag. This ad, the patriotism is so thick you could cut it with a knife. I mean, I had to hunt down the original article, and I subscribed to the New York Times just to get it, because I had to find it, and just to see how simple it was, and then to go to the embellished one was very shocking. So very interesting. But you can see just how they are equating ice cream with this American way of life, like how they were just clinging on to that. And you can kind of understand like how the world didn't understand this. Yeah. Now, the army went above and beyond too to provide ice cream for soldiers and sailors. And I found this great National Dairy Products Corporation ad talking about this. It's about the Army Ice Cream Factory, the BRL, which stands for Barge Refrigerated Large. It says, built of concrete, 265 feet long, it cost $1 million, and it's worth every penny of that to lonely American boys who are fed up with alphabet rations, however nutritious. Each BRL, the Army operates three, is a floating refrigerator and food factory. It carries 1,500 tons of frozen meat, 500 tons of fresh vegetables, eggs, cheese, and milk, and a big ice cream freezer. The machine can make 500 gallons of ice cream a day, with storage space for 1,500 gallons more. Can you imagine a greater tonic to body and spirit than real ice cream served in steaming jungles or on hard-won beachheads? It's a touch of home, as well as a valuable food. Many tons of the powdered ice cream mix that makes this possible are furnished by National Dairy. Yes. And finally, I wanted to point out that they had soda fountains themselves on Navy ships. And my good friend Kristen of Farm to Fountain Sodas, she was my partner in crime and research for this episode. I really have to give her a huge, huge shout out because she helped me with so much research. But we found this Coca-Cola ad that shows sailors at the soda fountain on their ship. But then she also found a reference, we believe is the photo reference for this ad, of sailors at a soda fountain on their ship. So really cool stuff. I hope I can get that on my blog as well so we can have a comparison. It's so cool. So that is all the military side, of course, but just I wanted to get this big picture of what soda fountains and ice cream meant to the Americans as a whole and the importance of ice cream itself. So what was the importance of ice cream in World War II? And I did kind of go over this in my ice cream episode, which I believe was episode 7. Please go listen to that because I go over a bunch of good stuff in there. But the obvious one is morale. It was a morale booster for our men and women in the service and for those at home to have such a familiar comfort food still be available. The other part was that it was considered a vital war food. Not just important comfort food, but important part of nutrition. In the Miami News, dated 4th December 1942, an article reads, Miami ice cream makers and dealers were pleased to learn Friday that Washington officials consider ice cream a food, not a confection. The making of it may be restricted if the war lasts, but it will not be discontinued. And that's a really important distinction. They were waiting to hear if the government classified ice cream as a confection or a food, and that would make a huge difference in how it was regulated and how much of it they could make. And when it was classified as an important vital food, then I think everyone breathed a sigh of relief. Another headline proclaimed that the government considered ice cream a food, not a luxury. So never fear, they weren't going to stop anyone from making it. So that's very interesting that it was a food and not a luxury. If you ask the rest of the world, they would probably completely disagree. But to Americans, that was not true. It was a food. In the Carolina Journal of Pharmacy, in the September 1943 issue, they talk about this as ice cream as part of nutrition. They say ice cream has become definitely established as a nutritious dairy food, valuable in the diet of all of us. It has taste appeal that makes it a favorite with almost every class of customers. It is recognized by nutritionists as an important way in which to get milk nutrients in the diet, particularly for those who take milk irregularly, if at all, as milk. Children particularly eat lots of ice cream, and this too, authorities say, is all to the good, as they need extra supplies of the very food elements ice cream contains. So there you go. Children need that ice cream, okay, folks? I think my kids would agree. What's interesting is that later in this article is that they give the energy equivalent. So a quart of ice cream, they say, supplies between 1,100 and 1,225 calories. And then they give the energy equivalent of that in other foods, like 1 pound of ham, 15 to 16 eggs, as if like saying, you know, it's just as good as these things. So it's like stretching it a bit, in my opinion. Also in the Health for Victory Meal Planning Guide, October 1943 issue, their main focus in that issue is that milk is a food. They say milk is an essential food, so do not consider it only as a beverage. Drink milk if you like, plain and cocoa or mixed with citrus fruit juices. Serve it at all three meals a day, often in made dishes, desserts, soups, and sauces. It's a good way to fool the family if they think they don't like milk. And a good way to see that everyone gets a share of a less plentiful supply of this valuable food. They also called it a nearly perfect food in this issue. And then it's important to note that in this issue, there were recipes for 5 different ice creams: caramel, economy, grape nut, peanut brittle, and peppermint. So that's a lot of recipes in one place for ice cream, I think. And finally, in one more article in the Times Independent from Moab, Utah, dated 4th of June, 1942, they describe ice cream this way. Long regarded as the all-American dessert, ice cream is rapidly coming to be recognized not only as an economical food, but since it also contains all of the ingredients of milk, as one of the best protective foods. Within the past 8 years, consumption has risen from about 4.5 quarts per person per year to over 10.5 quarts per person per year in 1941. That year is rising rapidly. Ice cream takes that output of nearly 1 million cows. Wow. So just ice cream takes the milk from 1 million cows for that year. So that's talking about the nutrition aspect of ice cream in general. And I think that gives a clue into how Americans looked at ice cream. And if you remember past episodes, we've talked a lot about nutrition and how that was such a huge focus of the government to get Americans healthier, because there was a lot of malnutrition in boys wanting to sign up to join the army and other branches of the military. And this was a huge concern that they just were not fit enough. So the fact that they're focusing on nutrition and ice cream is just one way to get that that milk nutrition in there, it's not really a surprise. So now we're going to turn to the soda fountain industry itself. There were problems for the ice cream front, which, like I said before, I did talk about some of this in the ice cream episode, but we are going to be talking about the grassroots problems that the soda fountain industry was facing as a direct result of the war. So the nitty-gritty stuff, you know, that I like so much. Soda fountains fell under the class of non-durable goods manufacturers. In this fantastic book called Wartime Dealer Aid Programs by Walter Frederick Crowder and Charles Henry Seven, this was published in 1944. It sounds very dry, but it actually has really fascinating things about different industries during the war and how they were solving problems. So if you're into that kind of thing, this is the book for you. So the three main problems facing these non-durable goods manufacturers were manpower, so the labor shortage. There was the enlistment of so many men into the military. They were left with less help and needed to train new or green help. So some soda fountains were forced to close due to the labor shortage. One article in the Buffalo Evening News reported at least 4 druggists in Buffalo have closed their soda fountains because of supply shortages and inability to get workers. They say, "I don't see how many of us can stay open unless the state labor laws are relaxed." One of the largest employers of fountain and counter help said, "Under the laws, we can't employ women under 21 after 10 p.m., and we need them. Many people working in plants drop in before going to work on the night shift, and we have difficulty serving them." One druggist said, "We wouldn't be surprised if the Manpower Commission declares an emergency relating to employment of restaurant, drugstore, and laundry workers and permit their employment during hours when they are needed. The number of workers available for drugstores has been reduced because boys 16 and 17 are being hired in war plants. Curtailment of ice cream and syrup manufacturing is an additional hindrance. Some stores no longer sell ice cream cones." So from this particular article, there you can see several problems. So besides, there's some specific laws that they're grappling with that aren't allowing women under 21 to work after 10 p.m. And with all of the plants and the night shifts, that creates a big problem on how to serve these people that want to stop in at the soda fountains or the drug stores that have like the soda fountain features in them. How are they going to help these people? And then there's also elements used in the soda fountains like syrups and ice cream cones that are also hard to get a hold of. And we'll be going into that a little bit later. Now, the wartime dealer aid program assisted with this problem by providing movies and slides, which the retailers could show to their new employees, written and amply illustrated booklets, and a few concerns have gone so far as to set up training schools in the metropolitan areas for the purpose of training green help. Advertisements are carried in local papers announcing the training program. The employees are paid by the manufacturer during the training period, and the trained help is then turned over to the retailer. So this wartime dealer aid program was to help the, so the manufacturers would kind of take on the hard work of, you know, training these people and then turn them over to the retailers after that. So they're kind of trying to work hand in hand to help each other out. I found a newspaper article about Soda Fountain and Luncheonette training schools in the Kingsport Time News from Tennessee in June of 1945. The headline is 35 Kingsport Girls Earn Certificates in Soda Fountain Luncheon Course. So it was a two-week course learning the preparation of various types of sandwiches and lunches along with soda and ice cream. And so it's training these girls to do this work because all the men have gone. The second problem that soda fountains were dealing with were rising expenses. You know, it's wartime. There's scarce supplies, great demand, so prices are going up. There were management guides or manuals made with suggestions for lowering costs, including things about operating at a lower sales volume. And this was kind of in general for the whole non-durable goods manufacturers. So it didn't, this wasn't just for the soda fountains. It was kind of across the board. I found the most interesting way of coping with this was, they say, the successful low-cost methods which ingenious and progressive retailers have developed are written up and passed on to other retailers. Group meetings and clinics have also been used to acquaint dealers with the successful experiences of others. Awareness of the general lack of record keeping on the part of small retailers has led many manufacturers to urge retailers the need for and the value of adequate records. Simple, easy to keep record systems have been provided, and the use of records as a management guide have been explained. So there's two parts to this. I thought it was so interesting that retailers that have come up with ingenious ways to lower their costs are sharing it with each other. And they have meetings and clinics to share that knowledge. And then they became aware that some people weren't keeping the greatest records. And of course, in a business, record keeping is kind of your life. You need to have good record keeping systems. And so they provided guides and encouraged them to just keep better records. So just education even, so they could do better in their business and not go under. The third problem that they faced were government regulations. So with wartime came a lot of government regulations, and navigating them was a very tricky business. Some manufacturers developed materials to help the retailers comply with government regulations. So that was helpful. At times, their quotas were cut even more to allow for regular consumers. Starting March 1st, 1943, more foods were to be added to the supply for householders by trimming down on the rations of soda fountains, roadside stands, nightclubs, and similar establishments, which in some instances have been receiving larger allotments than restaurants and cafes dealing solely in food. So that was in an article I found from the Times Record of New York. So dealing with various rationing and then quotas that they were allowed to have based on sales, previous sales. I mean, it was definitely a headache. Then there were the rationing problems. And soda fountains were affected in a multitude of ways. Because if you think of all the concoctions they made, think of all the ingredients that went into each one. I don't know if you've had a look at a soda fountain menu, just even the ice creams and the ice cream sodas, the sundaes. Some of them can have, you know, 7 or 8 ingredients or more. If you followed me on Instagram, I made a few of these concoctions myself, and one of them had like 8 ingredients. So think of all the ingredients that goes into these, and then think of how the war impacted each one of these individual ingredients, from sugar to chocolate. So I'm going to break down a few of them here. To help with gas and rubber shortages, the government requested that ice cream manufacturers limit their flavors to just 20 at a time to cut down on deliveries. So here we're talking about just the flavors of ice cream that they're able to offer. In the Tampa Tribune, there was an article that said, the government has limited ice cream manufacturer to 20 flavors for the duration, which must come as amazing news to the chap whose slogan always was, make mine vanilla. Gosh, you mean we gotta get along with only vanilla and chocolate and strawberry and raspberry and rum and coffee and ginger and coconut and lemon ice cream and 11 other flavors? So I think that's funny. The guy's like, seriously, I think we'll be okay. But that's true about vanilla, though. My father-in-law, that's his jam. He just goes for vanilla every time. Another company said it was choosing to focus on just 6 flavors: vanilla, chocolate nut fudge, strawberry revel, butter brickle, yum, that just sounds good, bonbon, and cherry nut. So some of them just, you know, were like, we're just going to cut it way down and just do 6. Later in December 1942, so that first one talking about the 20 flavors, that was May of 1942. This is later in December 42. They talk about cutting it down even further to 10 flavors. So that was short-lived. And that's really, think about even just the ice creams themselves, the different things that go into all the flavors. It's just a lot of stuff. So then we're going to talk about sugar rationing a little. In the Miami News, 4th of December, 1942, they say, already one large manufacturer is experimenting with corn syrup, corn sugar, and honey mixed with his sugar quota to make every grain count. Doing this, he barely fills the demands of local appetites. So this is a good demonstration of how ice cream manufacturers are having to kind of manipulate their ice cream recipe to deal with the sugar rationing. It's a very tricky business, because to maintain the consistency of your ice cream, you can't always just, you know, swap something out, you know, 100%. So yeah, they really had to figure it out with this guy's kind of clever, using a mixture of things: corn syrup, corn sugar, and honey. With the sugars. Next problem is the dairy and butterfat shortage. And we're not just talking about the ice cream manufacturers that affected the soda fountains. We're also talking about like whipped cream and stuff, which was a huge component of soda fountains. That's like the topping on your amazing sundae or ice cream soda. Also in the Miami News, an article says, dealers here, unable to get fresh milk for their formulas, refuse to let the problem lick them. Some are using a combination of fresh cream and condensed milk. So it's talking about the ice cream mix. Some are making ice cream from butter, but a butter shortage also threatens. According to an expert, only an expert can detect any difference in the flavor when ice cream is skillfully made of fresh milk substitutes. It's just as nourishing, he added. So getting that plug in there. I have never thought about ice cream being made with butter. That is so interesting. So once again, like, you know, remaking the mix, not just changing out, swapping out the sugar, but swapping out the types of milk and milk fats being used in the ice cream so that they can keep up that the ice cream supply, because Americans must have their ice cream. In episode 7, Ice Cream Goes to War, I talk about the Sidwell Dairy Company, who adapted by switching to a wartime formula to make their ice cream with the restricted butterfat. Well, in my research this time, I found the Seal Test Ice Cream Company. They took a different tack. They did not change their formula, but they just made less ice cream, and they advertised that fact. They say, such fine ice cream is a feat in the face of government restrictions on ingredients, possible because we are making less of it than you might like to have. But then that makes Freshling's Seal Test Plum Ice Cream all the more welcome and refreshing when you do find it featured at your dealers. They're like, well, if you're lucky enough to get it, it's going to be the good stuff. They also made signature Royale flavors that had ribbons of fruit or other flavors like fudge or butterscotch that went through the ice cream. And that actually helped bulk out the ice cream supply. So that was their other tactic, was to stretch the ice cream available. Next, we're going to talk about chocolate, vanilla, and banana shortages. I've talked about banana and spice shortages in my other episodes, so I won't go too much into that here, but I just wanted to at least mention it, that that was a concern for ice cream makers and soda fountains for their syrups and stuff like that. Vanilla was a huge, huge thing. Bananas, of course, for banana splits was a big deal. I found an article talking about how this one man knew how much the kids love banana splits, so he pretty much cleared out the banana supply in their city just so that the kids could have their banana splits. So, I mean, if they were available, they were available. If not, well, you know, I guess you couldn't get your banana split. The other soda fountain casualty was chocolate. There were many things made from chocolate besides chocolate ice cream. There was the chocolate ice cream soda, chocolate milk shake, chocolate syrup, chocolate fudge topping. This was a very sad thing. And I found a number of articles talking about how, you know, if you can get it, enjoy it while it's there. But, you know, it's going to be gone. This shortage of chocolate was due to a lack of cargo space. The cargo space in the ships, which brought over 40% of the world's supply of cocoa to the United States ports, is now mostly taken up by vital materials of war. And I didn't find articles about this, but I would have to say that a lot of the cocoa supply was also taken up by the military to make their delightful waxy chocolate bars that didn't melt. Another problem arose that exacerbated the shortage was when some importers bought large stocks of chocolate from Cuba without critical attention to labeling and composition. These were forced to relabel a high proportion of the lots imported before they could obtain their release to show the presence of adulterants such as starch and cocoa in products purporting to be chocolate. That was an article in the Miami News from 1944. That wasn't so good. So they thought they were getting all this great chocolate, but oh, just kidding. There's other things in it. And in this other article I found from the Kenosha Evening News of Wisconsin from August 1942 about the chocolate milk casualty, it says, Professor Pete S. Lucas of the Michigan State College research staff predicted today that if the chocolate shortage continues, children who refuse plain milk will get it flavored with root beer, butterscotch, raspberry, strawberry, or caramel. He said the college was also seeking to develop fruit coatings to replace chocolate on ice cream bars. So I don't know if you were one of those kids that love drinking chocolate milk. I myself was not one of those, but I was a weird plain milk kid in school. But I did try a root beer milk on Instagram. I posted about this. It was actually pretty good. And, you know, if I had to do without chocolate, I mean, chocolate milk is enjoyable, but I think I would go for root beer milk. It's pretty tasty. If you had to go without chocolate milk, which one of these would you choose? Yeah, those poor kids had to do without chocolate milk. But I find it interesting that this college was developing these different flavors to replace the chocolate that they weren't going to be able to get, and that they were developing fruit coatings to replace chocolate on ice cream bars. I did find another article talking about that chocolate ice cream bars were going away because they just couldn't get the chocolate. But the fruit coatings, that sounds interesting. And finally, we are going to talk about the very fascinating topic of the CO2 shortage. Ice cream was a huge portion of the soda fountain business, but they also sold soft drinks or soft drink and ice cream combinations. So while it was a major ingredient for soda fountains, CO2 was used heavily for the war. So they had CO2 tanks at the soda fountains, and they would manually add the fizz to your soda. So, when we go to a restaurant today, you just put your cup under there and it comes out mixed for you. Well, they mix it for you at the soda fountain themselves. The syrup goes in, the CO2 water mix goes in, which is your carbonated water. So this was a super important component of soda fountains, and the shortage of it was a huge concern. There was one article that had the headline, "Soda Pop Fizz Utilized as Vital Power in Saving Lives of Men in Aeroplanes." I found this to be really important and very interesting because this demonstrates what CO2's role was in the war and why maybe it was so hard to get for soda fountains. This is from The Courier from Waterloo, Iowa, dated 3rd November 1942. It says, "The fizz of your soda pop, liquid carbon dioxide, has become a midget power plant in war. A fighting plane crashes at sea, power dead, electrical lines gone, hydraulic systems smashed, stunned crew barely crawling out as the water slips over the sinking ship." And by ship, they mean, in this case, an airplane. "At that instant, a door lifts on the fuselage against even the weight of water flowing over it. Out of the opening fairly leaps a rubber boat, inflated, equipped, ready. No one even presses a button. It is all automatic and all done by one small bottle of carbon dioxide, which has lain for weeks in its packing back under the barely noticeable door." So these CO2 canisters played several different roles in saving lives of men. It lifts the doors. It inflated the rubber boat. It opens the bomb doors. It also inflated the rubber Mae West vest into a life preserver. This vest had two cigar-sized cylinders attached to the vest to do the inflating. And I believe they were manual, so the men could inflate them themselves. They also extinguished fires. So there were canisters that extinguished fires on the airplane. So this, CO2 was extremely important in saving the lives of pilots, and the CO2 plants, were working overtime to supply this to the military. So we can see maybe why soda fountains and bottling plants maybe were, definitely second on the list. The soda fountain and drugstore industries were worried they wouldn't have CO2 to carbonate their sodas for the duration of the war, understandably. In the Carolina Journal of Pharmacy from September 43, they say, tracing this information... Oh, there was an article that talks about CO2. Oh, yes. "Carbonated water, a war casualty." That is the headline for the article. It says, "Tracing this information back into the office of one of the largest producers of CO2 gas in the country, we found that unusually heavy demands by the Army and Navy had drastically reduced the amount of this product available for civilian needs. Although this particular manufacturer had stepped up production of CO2 gas from 750,000 pounds to 3 million pounds per year, they were still unable to supply their regular customers and meet the increased demands of the armed forces. As a result, the firm voluntarily decided to limit civilian sales exclusively to bottlers. This short-sighted policy is creating havoc in the operation of many soda fountains. As a matter of fact, a number of fountains in Durham are already closed due to a shortage of CO2 gas. In defense of their policy, the firm contends that soda fountains can continue in operation by placing emphasis on milk drinks, fruit aids, etc., but that such is not the case with bottlers, who would be forced to suspend operation entirely if deprived of CO2 gas. The soda fountains thought this was nonsense, that this company was just like, well, we're just going to serve the bottling plants because if they don't get CO2, they have no product whatsoever. But, you know, soda fountains, they've got a whole bunch of other stuff they can offer for sale, so they don't need it. So they're like, that's crazy. Bottlers called for cylinders of gas. Oh, so this is the point that they're making. Bottlers called for cylinders of gas and returned them empty within 3 days, while soda fountains used a single cylinder for a period of time between 3 and 6 months. So they're like, that's just a dumb argument. I mean, we don't use nearly the same quantity as bottlers do. They went on to argue, we can see no justice in depriving 4,000 soda fountains of carbon dioxide gas in order that 135 bottlers may continue to do business as usual. Assuming that there will be an insufficient supply of the gas to meet normal civilian needs in the future, why not allocate whatever amount is available to both bottlers and soda fountain operators on the basis of past purchases? So, I mean, they're offering a very reasonable solution to the problem. Now you can see that they were getting a little bit salty about what was going on, and justifiably so, I think. It was not an easy problem to deal with, this shortage of CO2. And, you know, I've really only scratched the surface of all the things that soda fountains had to put up with during the war just to provide Americans with their ice cream. And, you know, it wasn't just civilians that were going to these soda fountains to find, you know, some relief from stress, a break from work for lunch, but it was these American GIs that were on leave. They would come to these soda fountains and just get that nostalgic home feel of just this dish of ice cream. It really was this iconic representation of what home was like. And, you know, it was something that they, just like in the advertisements, they were working hard to protect. And, you know, as hard as that is to kind of put into words, it really was, I think there is some truth to that. And as much as, you know, we can joke about it, this was an important aspect of American life then. And I'm pretty sure ice cream has not budged in American hearts since then. No matter what anyone says, ice cream isn't going anywhere. Today's cookbook feature is Soda Fountain and Luncheonette Management by J.O. Dahl. This was published in 1945, but it actually has a longer history than that. In the prologue, it says, urgent demand for practical guidance has come persistently from owners and operators of soda fountains and luncheonettes. They've been distressed to find that no more copies of J.O. Dahl's book, Soda Fountain and Luncheonette Management, were available. There is no book in existence which can take the place of this volume, which the author called the Book of 1,000 Ideas for Fountains and Luncheonettes. By great good luck, the publishing company which the author founded and operated successfully for 10 years was able to locate the type of the second edition. Other plans were changed to make way for the third printing to be included in the restricted wartime paper quota. Copy has been carefully read by authorities on this subject and necessary changes made to bring it up to date. So it is with great pleasure that we present the third printing of this practical book, which has been endorsed by thousands of men and women in the soda fountain field. And then, yeah, it's dated 1945. So this is a book that was created to help people who ran soda fountains and luncheonettes. And it really is like starting it from the ground up to operating it. It's got recipes in the back for successful menus. It is everything. In fact, when I was reading it, I was starting to feel like, hey, I could start a soda fountain. I won't, but I mean, I was feeling that, like, wow, this is great advice. Maybe I could do it. It's got chapters like planning for profitable business, 100 causes of failure before you buy or build, building the ideal shop, how to reduce operating costs, 97 business building ideas, what is good service, increasing employee efficiency, principles of food buying, simplified accounting methods, how to plan saleable menus. And then this is where it gets really fun. 72 profitable sandwiches, profitable salads and specialty dishes, 55 popular toast dishes. Oh my goodness. How can there be so many? Desserts that ring the register, 98 fountain profit makers. I mean, that alone was worth buying this book. So, yeah, the recipes alone were definitely worth it. And so really fascinating book. And on Instagram, I posted the complaints, like the common complaints that they kind of surveyed soda fountains, luncheonettes around the country. And so he compiled 101 failureisms. And it was a very fun discussion on Instagram of, you know, what people commonly complained about at soda fountains. Some of them are legit complaints. Others, it's like, rude. So if you wanted to take a look at those, I've got them over on Instagram. I won't go over them here just for sake of time. The fountain recipes, 98 fountain profit makers, are very interesting. Even just the basic chocolate ice cream soda, chocolate syrup, number 16 ladle vanilla ice cream, and a tablespoon of whipped cream. That's it? Oh, that's so disappointing. I don't know if it's because of wartime or if that's just the recipe. And then they've got all these different variations. Now, something interesting about these recipes is the size of the ladles or the disher or the they've got different terminologies and sizes. And unless you have these correct sizes of scoops and things, I don't think you can make it accurately. So that's the downside of this particular cookbook. And something that my friend Kristen and I are planning on doing more research into that. So very fun stuff. So unlike my previous episodes where I usually make a recipe from my cookbook feature, I am not going to do that this time because I have other plans, but I wanted to at least feature this because it was, you know, very valuable in research for this episode, and it's just worth mentioning. I will have pictures of this on my blog, and it's a really valuable book for that time period. And it's just such a rare delight to find something like this. So I will be sharing images of it there. So what recipes did I make? Well, I did show them on Instagram, some of them, but I wanted to talk about them. So I was doing research on patriotic soda fountain creations that were inspired by wartime. These are so interesting. And Kristen and I found all of these in the newspapers. So there was one newspaper line that said, advertised in the window of South Grand Boulevard drugstore. Victory Sunday, blackout soda, and dive bomber sandwich. So you can see how they got creative in wartime. That was from the St. Louis Globe Democrat in 1942. Another ad advertised an invasion Sunday, but sadly nothing describing what was in it. That was from the Sepulpa Herald from Oklahoma in 43. But there were other ones that were very generous in telling you exactly what was on the sundae. Not like amounts, but that's okay. Like, we can just, it's easy to recreate it and just make it yourself. Just knowing what's on it helps a lot. Now, for these recipes, I did make the wartime ice cream from my last episode. It was the military ice cream, and I made a batch of that, and I was using it for these recipes because that to me was important, that I use a wartime recipe, because the sugar levels would be different than if I used like a ice cream from the store. So that to me was important to recreate. And the ice cream was delicious. I mean, I made it again. I made a vanilla version last time. I made chocolate, and the vanilla version was fantastic. I made two batches of it, and I made a batch for my son who cannot have dairy. I made it using almond milk, and for the cream I used coconut milk and cream, and it turned out great. He loved it, and he keeps asking me to make it again. So I do plan on doing that. All right, so first up is the Victory Sunday. And the headline for this is "The First Lick Goes to Uncle Sam." I love that. So it's described as a big scoop of vanilla ice cream topped with chocolate fudge, a big scoop of chocolate ice cream with whipped cream, and a maraschino cherry. It was 25 cents, including a 10-cent United States defense stamp. That's how it was described in the Daily Tar Heel from North Carolina. But the Victory Sunday actually didn't really have a recipe. Any Sunday could be considered the Victory Sunday. They just charge you for the Sunday plus an extra 10 cents, and it was served with a defense stamp. And that was kind of your way of helping out the war. And yeah, so that's kind of a really fun concept that you could, you know, get a saving stamp for your booklet and eat some ice cream too. Next up was a really fun ice cream sundae called the Blackout Sundae. Now, there were a lot of versions for this one. Kristen found this article, and we think that this might be the origin to the Blackout Sunday. This is from the Herald and News from Vermont, dated June 25th, 1942. It says, "A Blackout Sunday had a Newport soda fountain clerk stumped. Little Susan Crandall put in the order after the six-year-old heard her big brother order a chocolate sundae and noticed that Newport was to have a Blackout Sunday." As in the day Sunday. The mix-up was rather natural, and at the same time, it handed the fountain clerk an idea. Now, soda fountains, they would make these creations, and they're very localized, but sometimes they would spread, and this is, you know, maybe one of those things that spread, like wildfire. Who knows? Now, I mentioned the Seal Test Company before, the ice cream company. They had a few versions of the Blackout Sundae. One of them was a double mound of Seal Test Butterscotch Royale ice cream, blacked out under thick fudge topping and smothered with shredded coconut. Yum. There was another one that was the Fretchling Seal Test version. It was vanilla ice cream covered with a generous portion of chocolate syrup, marshmallow topping, and whole peanuts. And I believe Kristen made this version on her account. So go to Farm to Fountain Soda on Instagram, and she has all kinds of fantastic soda fountain stuff on there, including the creations that she's made. She's even made some soda recreations. I have not even touched the soda recreations. I just did ice cream. So definitely go check her account out. The third seal test version was vanilla ice cream, a few generous dashes of chocolate syrup, a sprinkling of crunchy peanuts, and a topping of whipped cream. Then there was the Seminole Made brand version. They had vanilla ice cream blacked out under thick fudge topping. That's it. Very basic. And then there was Heinz's Blackout Sundae, chocolate ice cream entirely blacked out under a taste-tempting fudge topping topped with fresh pecans. So I tried the seal test version using vanilla ice cream, a few generous dashes of chocolate sauce, crunchy peanuts, and whipped cream. It was delicious. And I did make my own wartime chocolate sauce as well, the chocolate syrup. It was a 1942 recipe from the Health for Victory cookbook, the December issue. So, and it was made with honey, and it's a really yummy recipe for chocolate syrup. And then with those crunchy peanuts on top, yum, yum. All right, next up is the General Douglas MacArthur Sundae. I have to say this is one of my favorites because it was really fun. There are two versions of this sundae. The first one is vanilla ice cream, blueberry and strawberry sauce, toasted coconut and whipped cream, and a small American flag. Then I found another version that was even more epic. It was two scoops of vanilla ice cream, a scoop of strawberry ice cream, topped with blueberry, fresh strawberry, crushed pineapple, smothered in whipped cream, fresh roasted pecans, Nabiscos, and a whole sweet cherry. So what did I do? I combined the two. So what I essentially did was I made this second version, but then just topped it with the American flag. And what did I do for that? I couldn't just use like a regular modern toothpick flag. No, I made my own 1940s correct 48 star toothpick flag. So it was awesome, I do have to say. And it tasted delicious. And guys, I mean, I'm not actually an ice cream fan. I ate more ice cream for this episode than I've eaten probably in a whole year. So I was on a sugar high that this. Next up is the very satirical, eyebrow-raising Hitler Sundae, or what I also found referred to as the Dead Hitler Sundae. The only description I found is that it was made with half nuts. I don't know if you get the reference there, that it's half nuts, that Hitler is half nuts. So, I made this and I just kind of made it up. I used hot fudge and then peanuts, then a little bit of ice cream, hot fudge, peanuts, a little bit of ice cream, and just layered it all the way up the sundae glass with whipped cream and a cherry on top. So it was literally half peanuts. Not to say anything about the name, which I find very disturbing, but the sundae itself was very delicious. I'm a big fan of peanuts, so peanuts and fudge, you can't go wrong. It was good. But yeah, I don't know. I guess it really does reflect on their sense of humor in the 40s. You can see this a lot in things that they had regarding Hitler and other Axis leaders. So not a big surprise that they had a sundae named after him. Yeah. There were a couple other sundaes that I found that I feel were inspired by wartime, but the connection's a little bit looser. But I thought I'd throw it out there anyway. One is the Hawaiian sundae. It was two dips of strawberry ice cream, fresh crushed strawberries, bananas, and topped with whipped cream and a charm doll. Or I even found a version that was ice cream served with fresh wedges of pineapple. Now, of course, this depended on how easily you could get a hold of these tropical fruits, but sounds good. The charm doll is interesting, too. This like little Hawaiian charm doll. Yeah. The other one was interesting, too. They said that it was a new flavor. This is for a Russian mint sundae. Because at the time, Russia was our ally, and that they were saying it was a new flavor. I feel like maybe they were, you know, pushing it as, it, I meaning it was like a wartime era flavor. So I'm not sure what would make it Russian. I have no clue. They did not say what was in the sundae, so I can't tell you. But I thought it was at least interesting to mention. So there you have it. These are the very interesting and varied patriotic ice cream sundaes that were on offer in World War II. There may be more. If there are any more to be found, I would love to hear about them. I will add them to my list of ones to try. But I will have these recipes up on my blog so that you can try these too, because they were all pretty delicious. So I had a few of you tell me that you had relatives that were soda jerks during the war, and I just love that. And unfortunately, though, they are gone now and are not around to share their stories with us. But for today's story highlight, I wanted to share another soda jerk story. But this will be another Hollywood actress. There were quite a few interesting Hollywood stories of actors or actresses that started out as soda jerks and were discovered by Hollywood and then went back to soda jerk roles in films. And I just found that very interesting. So this is one of them from the Lansing State Journal, dated 23rd of November, 1942. It's titled, Lana Turner Back at Jerking Sodas. She's right at home in role as she was discovered working at Fountain. Lana Turner, the little high school girl who was discovered by the movies in front of a soda fountain, stood behind one yesterday and discovered your Hollywood correspondent. Yes, sir, we just walked into the coast-to-coast small change mart, sat down on a soda fountain stool, and there was Lana scooping ice cream for a jumbo banana split. And what's more, she was blindfolded. Yes, blindfolded. A customer had ordered the jumbo banana split. A tricky order, even when you can see. But the blindfolded Miss Turner went into action like a drugstore commando. Two steps right, a dish. Back a step, a banana. Split it with a knife. Three steps to the right, ice cream ladle. Three scoops of ice cream. Ladle of fudge. Reach, in icebox. Whipped cream. Nuts, sprinkled evenly. A cherry. There, said Lana, removing the blindfold. But by this time, we were occupying the fountain stool where the customer was supposed to be. Nice going, we said, digging into the jumbo banana split. You, Lana thought fast. She whirled around to the cash register and punched out a $2.50 check. She whirled around again, laughing. $2.50, please, she said. It was worth it. Who wouldn't dent the family bankroll for a jumbo banana split or even a little chocolate malt with Lana Turner on the side? Yep, after 6 years, Lana Turner has completed one of those Hollywood cycles, from an unknown in front of a soda fountain to a movie star behind a soda fountain. She goes behind the fountain to play a soda jerker for a picture titled Nothing Ventured. And how do you like this, says Lana. In one scene, I tell a customer to move on if he isn't going to order because the management doesn't allow lounging. Me, the gal who ordered a 5-cent Coke in the drugstore every day after school and spent hours reading all the movie fan magazines. So I found this really fun. And just the idea that she has kind of come full circle is cool. And it seems like she still had the skills. It's kind of like my first job was in a bagel shop, and I still use my bagel cutting skills, and I tell my kids that all the time. So anyway, that's it for today's episode. Thank you so much for joining me and for listening all about soda fountains. And if you want to see more, I share so much on Instagram. I hope you follow me there. It's at Victory Kitchen Podcast. And if you want to see the full list of my research resources and see all the images that I share, you can see that over on my blog, victorykitchenpodcast.com. Also, I want to, again, give a huge thank you to Kristen, who was my research partner in crime. She helped me so much with this episode. I can't even begin to tell you how much she helped me. Please give her a follow at Farm to Fountain Soda on Instagram and give her lots of love. She shares so many amazing things over there. Thank you so much for joining me, and I'll talk to you next time. Bye.